Welcome, everyone, to the Friday night public discussion group of Perfecting Horizons Institute. We are in paper 67, section 6, which is old single column, page 759. All right, we have the last chunk of this this paper and this block, this two-paper block on the Planetary Prince to finish up here. I don't think we need a lot of introduction. Now, you can see they gave, in the preceding section, they gave us, as the title says, the immediate results of the rebellion. They're going to play it forward a little bit, exactly how the loyal crew restructured themselves, what kind of a receivership of the planet got set up, who was involved, and you know, and they'll just wrap it up with those details. Everyone knows the little wrap up, the final section is about Amidon as the hero of the rebellion. So let's just jump in, and they're going to give us most immediately here some very interesting behind the scenes issues, including a reference that is very, very seldom brought up in the entire book. So let's see what they got for us.
Section 6, Van, the Steadfast. The followers of Van early withdrew to the highlands west of India, where they were exempt from attacks by the confused races of the lowlands, and from which place of retirement they planned for the rehabilitation of the world, as their early Badenite predecessors had once all unwittingly worked for the welfare of mankind just before the days of the birth of the Sangic tribes.
So if you don't remember, we're talking about, you know, when they mentioned Badenite predecessors there, recall that that was one of the two relatively pure, non-back-mated groups of original Andenites that was in that same, you know, what's today Afghanistan, eastern Iran, you know, region, Central Asian region, you know, back, way back 850,000 years ago, you know, the geography was different than it is today. But they're just pointing out that it's kind of interesting that you have that same region all those hundreds of thousands of years later, serving as a reservoir of integrity again. A place to try to conserve, you know, way back in the original one is sort of the potential for civilization, and now it's trying to conserve the beginnings of civilization and not have it just totally washed into the minimal peoples and lost, you know, as they're referring to the confused races of the lowlands there. And, you know, remember when they, in the book, here's another example, when they say something like west of India, you know, this is pre-Pakistan, so, you know, Pakistan's part of India, you know, so, you know, we're talking, you know, completely to the west of the Indus Valley, right, you know, in the highlands there. Let's see, and, you know, them mentioning, you know, again, the big contrast, like I said, the potential of civilization in the first one, back when it was all unwittingly working, as they're saying there. Now it's very much a conscious effort to try to, you know, to gather the troops in a a relatively safe location. They don't have the 40-foot wall now and everything. And try to stabilize the situation and try to work slowly, patiently forward from the residual crew. You got something?
Well, I'm just thinking, this is probably not a place given to agriculture. So I'm guessing they resorted to a herder-type life, I would imagine.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure in a number of cases, yes. You know, remember how you had a similar thing going from the first garden to the second garden? You know, you have to kind of drop back to the evolutionary mode. You know, you were trying to push things forward into agriculture, but now you have to kind of just fall back into the evolutionary situation and slowly, like I said, try to move patiently forward from there.
You grow a lot of poppies there.
Yeah, and definitely try to minimize the number of opium dens. Okay.
Before the arrival of the Melchizedek receivers, Van placed the administration of human affairs in the hands of 10 commissions of 4 each, groups identical with those of the prince's regime. The senior resident life carriers assumed temporary leadership of this Council of 40, which functioned throughout the 7 years of waiting. Similar groups of Amadonites assumed these responsibilities when the 39 loyal staff members returned to Jerusalem.
Okay, so they're giving these just these little tidbits. Because the question came up, last session. See, I gave you a heads up on this. See, so initially, Van and crew just said, well, let's just keep the same 10 groups that we had before. We'll just have 4 in each instead of 10 in each now. And let's try to just maintain as best we can. Like they said, this is before the Melchizedek receivers and the Most High Observer arrived. So, they definitely didn't want to put themselves out on a limb. It's like, well, let's not dream up any new scheme. Let's just go with what it was supposed to be as best we can. Try to maintain the truth of what was there before, even though we can't maintain it literally factually. And here is a great example, twice in that paragraph, before the arrival of the Melchizedek receivers and then throughout the 7 years of waiting. Remember how we pointed out, I mean, it was over in basically 2 years with all the celestials on Gerasim. It's the same thing here. I mean, you can tell from that paragraph. In very short order, all of the celestials had, picked, between the two camps. So it literally is, to all appearances, 5 years that it takes for the Melchizedek to arrive by seraphic transport, see? That just adds to that that speculation. Remember, there's 14 life carriers that got permission to stay, 2 senior ones, which is the ones they're talking about there, the senior resident life carriers, the 2 of them. Remember before they, in many ways, were in charge, especially before Will Creatures, they were totally in charge. There were those Melchizedek observers for the first 500,000 years there with the life carriers. But see, again, you can see how no one is trying to dream up some radical new idea. It's like, as best we can, let's kind of just fall back on what has been sanctioned in the past, and that should be okay. So that's why they're bringing in the life carriers, just to take up some temporary leadership, and as they did for so long. We'll get a little bit more of that here in just a second again, but, right at the end there, they're reminding you of how everyone except Van and Amnon, in terms of the immortals, is going to be taken off, taken to the mansion worlds or Gerasim or whatever, to start their ascension journey. All right. So now, now we'll get a little bit more specifics on what about all of the mortal and immortal Andonites, you know, very tightly associated with the planetary headquarters for all those years, that didn't join the rebellion. And that's what these Amidonites are about. So let's get those details here.
These Amidonites were derived from the group of 144 loyal Andonites to which Amidon belonged and who have become known by his name. This group comprised 39 men and 105 women. 56 of this number were of immortality status, and all, except Amidon, were translated along with the loyal members of the staff. The remainder of this noble band continued on Earth to the end of their mortal days under the leadership of Van and Amidon. They were the biologic leaven, which multiplied and continued to furnish leadership for the world down through the long dark ages of the post-rebellion era.
Okay, so you have 144, and so just a small group. Yeah, and it's fun that it's that number, and add to that. Notice that if you subtract the 56, you have 88, and if you subtract Amidon from the 56, you have 55. So it's kind of easy to remember the numbers. You have 55 and 88 and 144. These kind of simple to remember numbers, and then Amidon. Now remember, when they talked about Nod and crew, all the ones that joined the rebellion, including all the modified Andonites, plus there would have been just mortal. Sangix and the Andonites and stuff too, joined the rebellion. But back there, the key thing is the ones that used to be immortal immediately started procreating and produced the Nodites. Between the modified Andonites and the corporeal staff, those rebel ones that were all mortal now started mating and produced a new race of these, very much, kind of Adam and Eve-like, very much biologically upstepped mortals that founded the Nodite race. The Amidonites are not a new race, because none of the loyal staff, be they, the actual literal corporeal staff, the 40, or the modified Andonites, none of them started mating. There was no production from those loyal ones. Because obviously, like we were just saying, they're not going to do anything new. They're going to try best to just stick with the program that was supposed to be stuck to. Okay, so the Amidonite term is just indicating the culture that's going to get started under the influence of Van and Amidon with this Andonite nucleus of people, and eventually there are some Nodites that join in. Remember that that decided to forget this rebellion crew. I'm going to go join Van and crew. So there began to be this bit of upstepped culture, even if there wasn't a lot of upstepped genetics. That is worthy of a name to refer to that. Okay, and the way you know that is not there, but let me just go ahead and read this. When you get up to the Garden of Eden paper 73, if people are interested, that's page 821 in the single column. It's the third paragraph in section 1 there of paper 73. Let me just read that quickly about this issue. It says, the Nodites were the descendants of the rebel members of the prince's staff, their name deriving from their leader, Nod, one-time chairman of the Dalmatia Commission on Industry and Trade. The Amidonites were the descendants of those Andonites who chose to remain loyal with Van and Amidon. Ammonite is more of a cultural and religious designation than a racial term. Racially considered, the Ammonites were essentially Andonites. Nodite is both a cultural and racial term. For the Nodites themselves constituted the eighth race of Urantia.
So there was no Sangics in there, right?
Sangics start to blend into both the Nodites and the Ammonites. I mean, you know, not immediately, but...
Okay, Andonites are not Sangic.
Yeah, they're not Sangic. I mean, initially, you know, both the Nodites and the Ammonites were all Andonite, basically, genetics.
Even though there's a lot of Sangics on the planet.
Yeah, but obviously, because there's lots of Sangics, you know, in very short order, you start blending in some Sangic to both of them. And the reason that they gave, you know, they said it's you know, they didn't say it's absolutely not a racial term at all. Like I said, I mean, eventually you have some of those Nodites joining the loyal crew. So you get a little bit of that, you know, blended in. Right? But it's, you know, essentially not a race, you know, this isn't another race. You know, it's basically just, it's the Mesopotamian culture transplanted, right? It's the Dalmatian culture transplanted over there to the highlands west of India, right? And so the name of the people living in that upset culture is the Ammonites. Okay, now, you know, we don't want to belabor this because it's all speculation, but you know, obviously you have all these issues of exactly how this works with those who are translated to this local system headquarters. You know, you have these modified Andonites that obviously are being kept from fusing, but they have adjusters. Do they just basically kill them? The soul is transported, a Urantia body is built for them, their Urantia brain is put in, the adjuster plugs in, and off they go, just like with us? They're probably all first circlers, and at the point of fusion, if it wasn't being stopped, did they, you know, allow them to fuse here? And so they're, you know, they get transported by themselves there and then get a Urantia body built for them? Or, you know, we don't know any of these details. With the corporeal staff, with the 39, you know, less than, that, you know, apparently it's just, you just get rid of the corporeal form, is their Urantia nature can be transported, I guess is what you assume.
Is it translated?
Yeah, and they use that term just because you have this whole transition, you know, it's not just literally, you know, a transported thing. You know, and so when they talk about it, number of places in the book, they use that translated term. Yeah, right, to encompass all of these details that we just don't know the specifics of.
So it would have essentially been the same method that if there hadn't been a rebellion, and they probably.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. For the loyal ones, it's just, you know, it would have been just, you know, exactly like Van and Amadon were, translated at the time of Adam and Eve. See, and again, you wonder, it's like, well, but is there a differential about the technical details of how Van ends up there and how Ammon ends up there? Because here's Ammon, 150,000 years later, when Adam and Eve show up. You know, he still hasn't fused. He's got an adjuster. You know, so, you know, he's obviously going to be a first circler by then, you know. And, you know, one would think, you know, it's just, you know, being the adjusters not being allowed to fuse with him.
And they could have stopped, you know, eating the fruit, or they could have stopped, you know, it says they died a normal death, right? I mean,
the mortals.
Oh, that's the,
yeah.
You're talking 56 of the number were...
None of the immortals died a quote-unquote natural death. I mean, there's this whole mystery of how exactly...
They could have died.
Well, right. But
correct?
Yeah, I mean...
Just like the other guys.
Again, you know, you could... But what would be the point, you know, if you're ready to
be taken
off, why not just, you know, turn off the whole material body and go for it, you know?
I went to sleep.
But, yeah. Anyway, so... All right, so there, all those details are between the lines, and you can just speculate endlessly about exactly all the how that all worked. But one way or another, all the loyals, what be they modified Andonite or original, you know, 100 corporeal staff, they except Van and Amidon end up at the local system headquarters.
The counterpoint: they do mention that these Amidonites were the biologic leaven.
Right. And that's why I went back and read that other thing so you didn't get confused about what they mean by that. You know, we pass, there's a biologic leaven of culture right here that we pass on. I mean, you know, remember this group of mortal Andonites are not just any old Andonites. I mean, it's just 88 out of the gazillions on the planet, right? I mean, this is a very select group that were able to assimilate this culture. So it was, you know, see, again, that's why they reminded you about that best genetics of the Andonites with the, you know, Badonite clan, right? See, you have this kind of cream of Andonite crop genetically, because they're the ones that could relate to the planetary headquarters in the first place. Yeah. So, you know, it is very much like, you know, effectively like with the Badonites. That, you know, you've separated yourself from mating with lesser Andonites, and so you kind of, sorta, you know, the Neanderthals weren't literally a new race. They were still just Andonites, but they were the cream of the crop of the Andonites. And it's, you know, just like to indicate that differential from the run-of-the-mill back-mated Andonite, you call them Neanderthals. You know, we're doing the same thing here and calling them Amidonites. She's just very, they're just pointing out that you have effectively, for very different reasons, you know, the same sort of genetic, bounding away from lesser.
So, because they didn't have, they weren't sanguine, so they didn't favor one adjutant. It's kind of like they were, had a wholeness, and they didn't
yes.
have wholeness.
Yes.
Without any genius.
Right. They're naturally symmetric, but very low level.
But they must not have been that low.
And these are the highest of the low level. Right?
Right.
They're still Andonites, as we'll see, you know, that's the whole point of the final section of this paper. You know, Amidon is an Andonite, a sub-sangic will creature. And he was loyal. Okay? You don't want to ever forget that. Right? I mean, there aren't any lower will creatures. You know, you shouldn't call Andonites Homo sapiens yet. They're not that high. They're Homo. Like I said, I mean, they're effectively Homo erectus. Homo erectus without any back mating. Right? Yeah.
Okay. On that, you mentioned the 144. What is that number in the Bible in Revelation?
144,000. Yeah. Yeah. But remember, I mean, the key is just that you have 12 times 12. You know, you've got that special number 12, you know, whether or not you take 12 times 12 and multiply it by 1,000 or something or whatever, you know. But yeah, you just, you know, you have to always wonder, is that a little bit of supremacy? You know, that coincidentally, quote unquote, that ended up being 144. It's a very suspicious number. That, you know, there are no coincidences in supremacy. There's a, even in the midst of all this apparent chaos of the rebellion, there appears to, the order appears to be still manifesting, right? That a very seemingly non-arbitrary number, you know, appears, right? So, yeah, it's just, I think that's probably why they emphasize it, is just to remind you that no matter how much it seems like the parts have divorced themselves from the integrity of the whole, you can't, right? We're all inside of the whole, governed by the individuality of the whole. There is an order that's inescapable. You know, it's just there. There's nothing actually arbitrary and random about, you know, how I came to have the genetics that I have from my grandparents through my parents. It appears to be just an arbitrary sort of a thing in many ways, but it's not. Nothing is. Nothing really, you know, when all is said and done, there is no such thing as random. There is no uncontrolled fact. Every automaton is ultimately controlled. No matter how much it doesn't appear to be controlled, ultimately it is. Everything is ultimately controlled. There's a foundation of control that is immutable, inescapable. Yeah. So yeah, just that's why these patterns, you know, it's a pattern of the inherent order that manifests. And 12 is a fundamental number that's coming out of the pattern universe, just like 7 and
that
10.
That makes sense how John would say that, you know, in Revelations about the 144.
Yeah. Humans obviously were taught about the importance of the number 12 way back in ancient times, and you know, it just got into mythological stories and was carried forward. Yeah. Okay, so that's the deal with the loyal staff of all flavors, including the mortals, that started this this sort of improved Andonite stock.
Doesn't seem like very many of them.
And but of course it all started with two. Yeah. You know. Right? There's only two will creatures to start with. So, you know, it can start small. And maybe, and just made me think about that. Just I'll remind you, you know, if you go back to the administration of the local system, you know, remember with the 420 counselors, how the second one is a little bit mysterious. Remember how we talked about that? You have Onagar is the first one. You know, like, okay, Onagar. So he represents the Andonites. And then there's this Mansant, right? Before you get to Onomatalantan. And you're going, well, who's this Mansant person? Why is this some other Sangic? Or did one of the Sangic races get two instead of one? It's like, no, see, he's of that improved Andonite group that we're just reading about here, right? That's where Mansant comes from. He's that post-planetary prince Andonite stock that produced an exemplary individual. You know? So that's the deal with Mansant up there. All right, so back to the story here. So now, how do things roll forward? They're gonna, they've gotten all the technical details out of the way. Let's see how things roll forward here.
Van was left on Urantia until the time of Adam, remaining as titular head of all superhuman personalities functioning on the planet. He and Amadon were sustained by the technique of the Tree of Life in conjunction with the specialized life ministry of the Melchizedeks for over 150,000 years.
Okay, just a couple little technical things there, if they're confusing. So he's just the titular head, right? Obviously the Melchizedek receivers and the Most High Observer, are functional, final leaders, if you will. But he does maintain, as a titular head, just to remind you that, you know, he is there as a representative of the ongoing fact of the prince's administration. You know, that we don't have a new dispensation yet. Right? So you have this sort of titular reminder of the prince's dispensation going forward. So that's why that. And then remember how we pointed out it's not just a matter of eating the fruit of the tree of life and, you know, and da-da, you don't die. Right? It's just a means so that you can be plugged into this life ministry. Right? And so the Melchizedek's didn't totally shut that off. That's, you know, the Melchizedek's set up master physical controllers, you know, doing that ministry. They had to approve, right, that ministry going on in just the specialized mode of just for Van and Amadon. Okay, so that's what they're referring to there, is the Melchizedek's there being, you know, since they're the final says, they say, okay, yep, we're going to set this up in a very specialized mode just for the two of them.
Step into this chamber.
Yeah, yeah. Well, no, I mean, I'm pretty sure it's just, you know, it's just ubiquitous no matter where Van and Amadon are. Just like, you know, you don't see any wires plugged into plants, you know, for them to get, you know, energized by the master physical controllers, right? I mean, it's just ubiquitous. You know, the master physical controllers just have a ubiquitous presence on the planet. And but the Melchizedek's have approved the master physical controllers in charge of this to plug Van and Amadon into that, in the same way they plug every plant into, you know, mechanical mind ministry, say, you know. All right, so that's what that's referring to. You've got two elements to this not dying thing. You know, the internal mechanics that are catalyzed or upstepped or whatever word you want to use by the literalness of the fruit of the tree of life, and then what that allows them to be plugged into and what's being fed into them. I mean, again, we don't know exactly what kind of energy this is. I mean, that's never explained. So that's just, you're left to speculate about exactly what kind of energy is being fed into, you know, non-breathers, you know, or Van and Amadon, you know, I mean, all these various times when the master physical controllers are, you know, are feeding energy into the being so they don't have to stick things in the hole in their face, right, to get energy into their body. You know, remember, it's just, you know, literally that. You know, in many cases, it's literally the substitute for eating.
I have meat.
Okay. Right. Right. So you don't want to, you know, don't go all mystical with it. It isn't some magical thing. It's just some literal energy that's being plugged in. And okay. All right. Keep going here.
The affairs of Urantia were for a long time administered by a council of planetary receivers. 12 Melchizedek's, confirmed by the mandate of the senior constellation ruler, the Most High Father of Nerlashadek. Associated with the Melchizedek receivers was an advisory council consisting of one of the loyal aides of the fallen prince, the two resident life carriers, a trinitized son in apprenticeship training, a volunteer teacher son, a brilliant evening star of Avalon periodically, the chiefs of Seraphim and Cherubim, advisors from two neighboring planets, the director general of subordinate angelic life, and Van, the commander-in-chief of the Midway Creatures. And thus was Urantia governed and administered until the arrival of Adam, it is not strange that the courageous and loyal Van was assigned a place on the Council of Planetary Receivers, which for so long administered the affairs of Urantia.
Yeah, and you know, they're answering, you know, it's like, well, why is it not strange? Well, courageous and loyal. Right. He represents, you know, and that's honored, that standing unmoved phenomenon, wherever it may be. You know, why did Laniforge get the job to replace Lucifer? Right? Because he's tried and true. Right? Okay, this is a very, very fun paragraph. You know, very singular in many ways in the entire book. Okay, so we start out, you notice that, you know, they mention the 12 Melchizedek receivers, and like I said, most of the time they don't mention directly. Remember, there's a Most High Observer too, right? He's always there too. But in terms of kind of who's immediately taking over the kind of shepherding the mortals in the day-to-day affairs duties, that's not the Most High Observer, that's the 12 Melchizedek receivers. They're taking over those planetary prince and his staff duties. Yeah. Most High Observer is there, you know, to handle emergency stuff. That's why he's called an observer. He's observing mostly, and if he needs to step in and take over the reins with a regency, he will. But that's why he's not always mentioned. But they do mention, of course, that the Most High Father is, you know, behind setting this up like this, because the Verondadex take over in an emergency. They're the backstop for all this stuff. Okay, but then it gets into this very fascinating advisory council, and so they do have a loyal aide. We don't know what kind of an aide. If you're supposed to assume it's one of the seraphim, you know, that is part of his staff. I don't know. It ain't one of the loyal aides. You know, the two resident, remember, there's actually more than the two. Those are the two resident senior ones. So they're both going to stay on. So this special advisory council continued what people decided before the Melchizedeks got there. It's like, well, probably we ought to bring the two senior life carriers into play. They were given authority before, so it should be okay to give them authority again. Yep, that was continued on. Then you have this very interesting thing of setting up. This has a big impact on how this all is planned for eventually when you have Trinity teacher sons, you know, post-bestowal son, all that stuff. You know, long before you have the Trinity teacher son age, you know, dispensational age, you know, the Trinity teacher sons are planning for that all along, even though they're not actively, you know, in authority or anything. But you've got this special situation. You see, and you actually get one on this council.
Cool.
Okay? And that apprenticeship training Trinitized son, you don't have to go back there, but I thought they actually mentioned about such things. Back when they're talking about creature Trinitized sons, when you're talking about the ones that are either two Finaliters or two Havona Paradise ones, you know, those kinds. They work for various people, and eventually they end up working with the Trinity Teacher Sons. These adopted sons of high and glorified creature origin are the apprentices, student helpers of the Teacher Sons, et cetera. Just a simple example about how little passing things like that eventually, sure enough, find a place. Okay? So you've got this pair, Trinitized son and the teacher son are a pair. You've got Avalon, you know, that mysterious fact that that's apparently our kind of sponsoring local universe, and that's coming into play again periodically. So it didn't take up residence here, but occasionally stops by put in their input.
I was in surgery.
Yeah, I mean, here we've got a brilliant eating star this time, you know, not life carriers or whatever, but, you know, you've got, you know, whoever's the head of the seraphim and the cherubim. And remember, this is, you know, you don't have a Sapernaphim like you do. No, that's post-Pentecost that you have a Sapernaphim as the head of the seraphim. So this is, you know, probably a seraphim, one of the loyal seraphim, probably continuing on as the chief. Same way with the cherubim. Very interesting. You got advisors from two neighboring planets. See, so, you know, what would you guess? You know, is it maybe someone, two planets that are kind of in a similar developmental state? Maybe some volunteers from the prince's staff on those two worlds came over to help out? Or, you know, you can speculate. You know,
one of them could be the nearby.
Yeah, it could be. It could be that neighboring planet, yeah, that they talk about. You know, it could be one of them. Right. I mean, you could just, yeah, there's all kinds of speculation there. But here's the biggie. Right. The Director General of Subordinate Angelic Life. You could just blow through that. No. Stop. That's not cherubim.
Right.
They already mentioned cherubim and seraphim. Oh, that's the unrevealed order of angels. That's that lower order of angels below cherubim. That's where it's very definitive, right, that you have that other. You've got a director general of those lesser angels. Mm-hmm. The unrevealed order. And then Van. So besides the titular role, he actually has a non-titular role of being the commander-in-chief of the Midway creatures. The loyal Midway creatures.
Mm-hmm.
Just primaries, of course. Remember, a long time before we have secondary midwares. Right, so, and like they say, that's the way it rolled for 150,000 years, with that very non-typical setup. Cross-fertilization between planets, you know, even bringing in the, you know, cross-fertilization of local universes is very interesting. You know, just, you know, so there's this rebellion situation, and you know, remember I mentioned that, you know, immediately people were getting, you know, the mortals were getting some information about kind of the bigger picture beyond the local system, you know, in the wake of the rebellion. So you can see how there's an interesting side to a rebellion. It actually brings in more top down than would be normal. Right? And you know, as you go higher up, you go broader too, of course. Right? So you get this greater depth and vertical depth and horizontal scope that comes into play. So we got some influence that run-of-the-mill world doesn't ever get. You know, that probably feeds in very subtle ways into our future, because after all, kind of these people are seeing to how this ties into the distant future that Trinity Teacher Son, right, is right there.
Yeah. Yeah.
So just keep that in mind, that you're dealing with very long-term planners, and you know, most of what they're doing is potentializing, not actualizing. And if you only judge the efforts of the celestials by what you can see with your eyes, it's like, well, I don't see anything, so man, they must have dropped the ball. I better take it up and, you know, do something radical. No, it's because you need to learn to know that most of what the celestials are doing is not actualizing, they're potentializing. And if you don't see value, if you don't know potential, then, you know, anything that you basically are dreaming that the celestials are doing is just that, dreaming. Right?
It's kind of like sowing seeds.
Yeah, right. They're sowing seeds, because basically that's what they're there for, even without rebellion and stuff. Right? The evolutionary process is complete and integrous. It's whole. Right? It's not wanting something essential. They're there to just is kind of catalysts, and you know, and sowing seeds, you know, local potentializers. You know, basically, you're just trying to make sure that the evolutionary process plays out.
And we're an experimental planet.
Yeah, and so that requires more people to handle more knobs because it's an experimental world. Yeah, and making sure that the potentials that are supposed to play out on this experimental world still can. Right? And that you know, those broader potential needs of this world didn't get messed up by the rebellion. Yeah. So just, you know, that's I bring that up a lot because that's one of the radical things that the Revelation is trying to teach us about the way we've always thought about and rationalized you know, our engagement by celestial beings. You know, and we're always looking for something very overt and, you know, signs and wonders. Potentialities don't manifest as signs and wonders. I mean, usually a sign and wonder would indicate falseness, you know, in regard to celestial input. Right? They're not there to put on a show for us. They're there to work behind the scenes, seeing to the integrity of the potentials.
Yep. So here we are, you know, one of 37 planets, I think it is.
Yep, 37, yep.
Went astray. You know, Michael's not a supreme ruler yet.
Yep.
So he can't summarily just get rid of the rebellion.
Yep.
And I'm sure things like this are probably happening on some of the other worlds that are in the rebellion.
Yep, yep.
And you've got this, you know, when you look at this group, it's a pretty cool group, actually.
Yeah, very intriguing group.
Beings that are here, trying to keep us on track, or at least, you know, as you say, potentially
keep us from going fundamentally off track.
While at the same time, the other guys,
the bad guys,
are just doing the opposite.
Doing everything they can think of, right, to try to push it off track, yeah.
So from so many, you know, afar looking at this, is probably quite interesting,
yeah,
I think, of what's happening. Yeah, we're like the comic strip in Navidon. Everybody, that's the entertainment.
No, it's, but it is a, you know, that quote unquote comic strip of Navidon sort of idea. I mean, it is a very fascinating place for visitors to come, you know, because they're seeing dynamics in play that are seldom, if ever, seen, right? And it teaches then what I was just trying to suggest you try to challenge yourself to learn, right? It teaches them how to see potential, how to think, how to eternalize their thoughts more, how to see things in the long-term perspective more, right? And don't get lost down in the moment and hence divorced from truth, right? It's not the truths of time. You can't find truth in time, you know? And it's a fool's errand looking for it in time. They're the truths of eternity.
Father's way ends up being the right way.
It all has an integrity that can't be fundamentally broken. And to learn to at least know unshakably that that exists, even if you can't really see it yet.
Strengthens your faith.
Yeah. I mean, it begins with that faith grasp of that which can't be seen, and it can grow into trust. Right, that is more like actually seeing it. Right? You know, when it goes from faith to trust, it goes from grabbing a hold of something you can't see to something you can see. And that's why you trust. You don't just merely have faith.
Yeah. You're striking step, that's something literal.
Yeah, right. You see it and you walk upon it. The rock, not the sand. Right?
This predates the Archangel Circuit headquarter.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. I mean, all that Pentecost stuff. That's what I was reminding you. You know, remember, this is way before Pentecost. So, you know, right. All these things are still in a very rudimentary mode, you know, from what they are today.
Keeping us in the headlines.
Yeah. All right. Let's keep going here. You remember the 12? Yeah.
The 12
12 Melchizedek receivers of Urantia did heroic work. They preserved the remnants of civilization, and their planetary policies were faithfully executed by Van. Within 1,000 years after the rebellion, he had more than 350 advanced groups scattered abroad in the world. These outposts of civilization consisted largely of the descendants of the loyal Andonites, slightly admixed with the Sangic races, particularly the Blue Men, and with the Nodites.
See, there's that blending I was telling you about, and I mentioned it explicitly there. And again, like I said, see, these Amidonites, aren't a new race, but they are they supply these anchors of culture, right? They're the biologic substance for these anchors of culture around the world that Van sets up. Now, wouldn't it be interesting to know where those were? And, I'm sure many of them, you could go, oh, that's why history has these ties back to that location. See, I'm sure there's all sorts of, answers to mysterious questions about some things that come out of the mists of our history.
Seems like 350 and 1,000 years is not bad work.
No
cars, no communication. I mean, that's pretty good.
You bet. Yeah. They weren't wallowing there in pity. They got right to work and were working very vigorously.
Kind of like a
soul. Let's see. Anything else there? No. Let's keep going here.
Notwithstanding the terrible setback of rebellion, there were many good strains of biologic promise on Earth. Under the supervision of the Melchizedek receivers, Van and Abaddon continued the work of fostering the natural evolution of the human race, carrying forward the physical evolution of man until it reached that culminating attainment which warranted the dispatch of a material son and daughter to Urantia.
And that takes you, of course, up to, that getting checked and it's like, yep, you've reached the biologic plateau. We're going to send a material son and daughter. And so they did their best to, see, as they say, they're supervised. They're not doing things as kind of direct as Adam and Eve do with racial blending and those sorts of issues. They're just kind of giving a gentle supervision because they know whose boss, the god of evolution, is. Needs to not be constrained, needs to fully play out. So they're just making sure that the potentials are not getting thwarted and the potentials through the evolutionary process can actualize.
This biologic, when the physical evolution of man until it reaches the culminating attainment, we didn't change the way we looked, so it's not like physical, it's probably mental, isn't it?
A lot of mental, but there is some physical. There is an improvement in the details of the biology up until 40,000 years ago, the point that they're talking about, just prior to Adam and Eve coming. But you're correct. The most important thing is not the molecules directly of your body. It's what kind of mindal cells you can have. And you'll see they actually bring that up in the next section. Anything else there? Notice, like I said, supervision and fostering the natural evolution, just all those things I was stressing, you can see are actually there if you look closely. And how much of a challenge that is for any of us who have been steeped in the way humans have always rationalized things without honoring evolution like we should have. We have this very strong tendency to think of it as being naturally problematic and constantly needing God the Father-like intervention, you know, to micromanage it. You know, and that is very false. The only reason you don't see the actualities that you're looking for with your idealistic foresight is because you haven't allowed enough time yet for the evolutionary process to actualize the potentials. The potentials are all there. If you stopped differentiating between potentials and actuals, you'd see that your ideals, your fondest ideals, are already in front of you as potentialities. You know, it's just a matter of time, and they will actualize. All right. Yep, keep going.
Van and Abaddon remained on Earth until shortly after the arrival of Adam and Eve. Some years thereafter, they were translated to Gerasim, where Van was reunited with his waiting adjuster. Van now serves in behalf of Urantia, while awaiting the order to go forward on the long, long trail to paradise perfection and the unrevealed destiny of the assembling core of mortal finality.
Do the more straightforward latter part first. Van is probably finally fused with his adjuster now. Unlike before, he joined up with our planet here. But you can see he's like the 420 counselors, you know, that were one-time mortals. And, you know, even though they're fused with their adjuster, that sort of spirit gravity pulling them up inexorably to paradise is somehow being mitigated, so that they're functioning horizontally for a while before they're allowed to, you know, sort of join the elevator to paradise, as it were. Then the other, notice the very annoying, purposeful, fuzzy statement there, because they can't give us any of these details I was telling you about. Some years thereafter, right, they were translated to Gerasim. Right, so, well, you know that some of that is, you know, again, they're using that translation word. Some of that is transport time. Okay, there's the transport time. But you know, it's like, well, I mean, Van wouldn't have to go through any of the mansion worlds, but did Abaddon at least have to spend a little time on, say, the seventh mansion world or something? Or, I mean, you'd think he would need to get some sort of pre-Gerasim work, and who knows, would Van kind of go along with him again? Would he go back? You know how, you know, you go back as a teacher, you know, instead of going directly to Gerasim. And I mean, would he maybe? So see, they're just leaving all of these speculations open, you know, by giving you nothing where you can try to pin it down some years thereafter. I mean, just this.
Right after saying shortly.
Yeah. Right. I mean, it's like, right. So they're just, all of that bit is just left fuzzy. Annoyingly so. But, you know, even if you pin down all of the technical details of what's happening at the local system headquarters of the Mansion World or whatnot, I mean, there's still probably a 5-year travel time between shortly after Adam and Eve arrive and them getting to the local system headquarters. So,
and why doesn't it mention Abaddon there about being translated to Gerasim? I miss that?
Well, no, they did. They were translated.
The
two of them.
Van was reunited.
Did Abaddon need to get reunited with his adjuster? No, he's always had an adjuster, right? You know, it's Van who was here with no adjuster. Yeah, see? Yeah, so that's the deal there. All right, let's keep going here.
It should be recorded that when Van appealed to the Most Highs of Edentia, after Lucifer had sustained Caligastia on Urantia, the Constellation Fathers dispatched an immediate decision sustaining Van on every point of his contention. This verdict failed to reach him because the planetary circuits of communication were severed while it was in transit. Only recently was this actual ruling discovered, lodged in the possession of a relay energy transmitter, where it had been marooned ever since the isolation of Urantia. Without this discovery, made as the result of the investigations of the Urantia midwares, the release of this decision would have awaited the restoration of Urantia to the constellation circuits. And this apparent accident of interplanetary communication was possible because energy transmitters can receive and transmit intelligence, but they cannot initiate communication.
Okay, so if you don't remember, I mean, energy transmitters are one of the flavors of master physical controllers. Why can't they initiate communication? Because they're not persons, yes. Right? They're minded, but they're not persons. You know, so just notice that, you know, the father gives you personality, the father's the initiator.
Yeah.
See the literalness there?
I love it. You gotta love it.
Right. Okay, so that's, you know, that's what's behind that technicality. But, you know, you notice they threw in one word to try to tweak you to reflect and figure out what's going on. And this apparent accident. Was it really an accident? No, it just appears to be an accident. I mean, don't you think that the Most Highs knew that it wouldn't get... I mean, they're the ones that are ordering the circuits being cut and stuff. Right. So what's going on? Right. It's not that the Most Highs don't know what they're doing. Right. And, you know, and what's the whole point? Anyone can trust... If you get a message from the Most Highs that, you know, with a thumbs up on it, no, Van has to trust without any message. So it's really trust, right?
So why send it at all then?
Well, because they explained that here in the next paragraph, the next little paragraph, they answer that question, right? But. So we'll get that in a second. But the key there, see, before they gave you that technical issue of why it was sent, you know, technically, you know, the question is, why didn't it get there? You know, there's two separate questions. Why was it sent and why didn't it get there? And the why didn't get there is much more important than why it was sent.
Sure.
Right? And there's a truth flowing through that paragraph that you still live on a world that requires you to strike step with the truth that's flowing through that paragraph and not be, well, I want to see it. I mean, I want word. Oh, so you don't want to really demonstrate your integrity. Right? You're a timid soul.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, if you want to put Agendonter on your forehead... You got to rise to the challenge, right? You have to be able to stand without any hint that you're standing in the right place, right?
So does that mean by reading this revelation we lose our
agony? No, I think there's still a lot of potential for doubting all around us. Right.
Probably potentiated.
Right? I mean, think how... You know, if we're going to resolve the rebellion here, there has to be lots and lots and lots of things all swirling all around you that do nothing naturally but produce doubt in your mind. You have to be able to have a positive response to a negative stimulus. You stimulize to doubt, but you doubt not. Right? And it's not. And it's not that you doubt not because, well, the Most High Father said, "You're all cool, John. Nothing to worry about." you have in complete ignorance. You have to know otherwise, right? Ignorance of sight. That's the whole point. This is a world where those who take a hold of reality when it's not spoon-fed to them. Take a hold of reality. That's the point of this world. You know, and pining for, oh, I want someone to come with a silver spoon and feed me. No. you were born in the improper world for that.
Though revelation does help.
Yeah?
I mean,
right? Yeah.
Which is also the plan of the universe.
Yeah. I mean, it's not like there wasn't Van and crew way back then helping out and whatnot. You know, there are visible things. We're not left totally in the dark. But we're left enough in the dark where, unless you're discerning, it will appear that you're in the dark. How many people have no idea that this book is on the planet? Well, it appears to them that they're totally in the dark.
Well, and so many of the people that are supposedly providing light are in the dark.
Right. You know, and if you... Yeah, you know, there's many people that appear to no longer be in the dark because this book is in their lap. Right? I mean, and that by their fruits you know them. You know, as they engage the book and you look at their fruits, you know, they spew error. They're reading the same words you are, but they manifest error, not truth.
I must admit, when I first read this, it was, it really didn't get that through.
Yeah. See, and see, it's just very important to notice how, I mean, everyone, I mean, I was the exact same way. And initially, there's just all kinds of dissonance and conflict with that paragraph. So that's why I'm stressing it. You need to rise up above that lowly plane where that conflict lies and see the higher truth that's flowing through that paragraph. The power of that paragraph, right? You know, it all went exactly as planned. There were no mistakes, you know, made. But there is this little technical detail. Read that last little bit.
The technical status of Van on the legal records of Satania was not actually and finally settled until this ruling of the Adentia Fathers was recorded on Jerison.
We all know everything is very precisely recorded and all that sort of stuff. I mean, yeah, I mean, all the record keeping needs to finally get put in place. But, you know, in the midst of that, is it, you know, just pushing it a little bit further. Yes, and this wasn't resolved until just recently.
They found the email.
Van has spent the last, you know, 40,000 years.
100,000.
Well, I mean, you know, since he left the planet, you know, and has been up on Gerasim, he spent that whole time. It's like, well, you know, couldn't they send another note? No, Most Eyes didn't send a duplicate note, you know, or he's left still having to trust, you know, that he did what he was supposed to do. No one said, yep, you did exactly like you were supposed to do. You know, well, some people down there with him said that, but he's like, yeah, but I'd really like to hear it from the Most High Father because he's the boss of this whole situation. Nope, not a word.
You know, what's interesting is how these energy transmitters work. You know, so mm-hmm. It's going along, right? And then they cut the circuits, communication, so then it no longer has a will to keep going because it's not a person. So it's just like if you unplug the computer and it just kind of goes.
Right. I mean, It just. I mean, he has. You know, this is an entity, very brilliant-minded entity that possesses this. This information in his mind, right? And these circuits, remember, like mind conduits, right? You know, so that message can just, normally it would come into his mind through a mind conduit, you know, and then go out through one of these mind conduits from his mind. But that outgoing mind conduit was cut, and so there it is, just the forms are in his mind. He's holding them in indelible fashion, right, in his mind. There's no decay of the information in his mind. but he can't, you know, someone can stand, you know, think of how many beings were standing right there in front of him at various times, but he can't say, oh, by the way, I've got this message in my mind, and he can't tell them, he can't initiate communication. Because, see, from our perspective, he's just this fancy-minded machine.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I wonder why the midwife, how they found it. I mean, you know, they were looking, huh?
Yeah, they must have, you know, just
going through all those old
sort of dug through the, you know, there's obviously, you know, every, you know, this is telling you that just like, you know, we can track, well, where did this message from this hacker come from? You know, we can track it back through the internet, you know, what nodes it went through and whatnot. I mean, all that, all those records of, you know, every message is going through the communication grid. There's all this tracking of it and recording of when it got where and, you know, all this stuff. So they're just digging into all those records and figuring out.
There's an unread message.
You know, and you almost wonder, I mean, I suppose they, when they finally figure out, you know, I'm pretty sure it's in this energy transmitter, you know, then you get like an energy transformer to walk up, you know, they're persons and you can engage them and have the energy transformer talk to the energy transmitter and, you know, get the message out. Yeah.
I'm just trying to think about this need for approval, where that comes from. It's not the personality that needs approval. It's the self. The mind itself that wishes for approval. Yeah. I mean, Van is a mind itself. Yeah. He wishes for approval just like anyone else.
He wants validation that his self conforms to the whole. Mm-hmm. Just give me some validation.
Well,
tell me, yes, you do.
Eventually, I mean, they sent the message. They would, you'd think they'd eventually cop to it or, you know.
Well, see, I mean, you know, eventually it would have naturally been released. As soon as they hooked up the circuits again, it would have flown right out, and you know, the planetary government here would have received this message 200,000 years later.
This is an old one.
Yeah, and that would have been just totally fine if it didn't happen till whenever the, you know. That's totally fine with, you know, if Van had to wait another 100,000 years or whatever, it's totally fine with the Most High Fathers.
Yeah, it wouldn't have come through yet,
would it? No, it wouldn't have come through yet.
This guy's on the
Nalliter
now. What should we do with that?
It's like, you know, they send it to paradise. Oh, by the way, Van, yeah, it was okay. It's like, well, I kind of assume so, since I made it all the way to paradise.
How this is different for the ones who went into rebellion. Are they, it's kind of like they decided, I don't need anyone's approval.
Yeah, well, see,
the desire for approval isn't just a negative
thing. Right, see, and that's the difference between righteousness and self-righteousness. You know, to be self-righteousness is to say, no, I don't need to conform to some whole, I am the whole.
Right, you're right.
Yeah. But righteousness is about conformity with the cosmos, conformity with the whole. Right? And you want that feedback. Am I righteous?
Yeah.
Right? Not, well, I'm righteous by definition. You know, that's the third principle of the Lucifer Manifesto, that you're righteous by nature. You're innately divine. Because you're self-righteous. Yeah.
Some other text. Because when you say validation, we're conforming to the whole. That's nowhere on the planet that I know of, other than in this book.
I mean, the Greeks, you know, when philosophy began in earnest in the 6th century BC with the Greeks, it didn't take them long to recognize that there's the whole and sort of the individuality of the whole. They had the essence of that. They had the universal mind idea that you were trying to consecrate your mind to, you know. So, you know, they didn't use these technical terms like, you know, like we're doing here. But, you know, see, it's only when you get a philosophic, reflective mind going that this becomes apparent. You know, again, pardon the pun. It's apparent that you have another parent, right?
Get your shame.
Yeah.
Get your sign out.
When you're just in that initiating mode with the, you know, initial primitive religious mode, it is not apparent. right? That there's any wholeness you need to conform. See, that's why it's so easy for someone in that immature state to go to self-righteousness. Once it's apparent that there's a hole, I mean, you lose all notions of that you are a hole. I mean, when you can see the hole and you can see that you're a part in that hole, you don't go, "Oh no, there's no hole. I'm the hole." You don't go to self-righteousness anymore. Hey, it's that dangerous time of being activated religiously, but not yet having philosophic integrity that you can go to self-righteousness. Right? And that we're in that danger time as in a collective way. That's why a philosophic text has been given to us. Try to get us to contextualize ourselves as a part that needs to be in cooperative subordination to the whole. No one is a whole. No one stands unto themselves.
You don't sit around and don't do anything. You just have to... What have you done for me lately?
Yeah, you're going to still be activated by that spark, that religious spark, right? They may not act wisely, they may act irreligiously, but they act, right? I mean, you're still going to have that spark, but it's going to be contextualized so it doesn't fly off into self-righteousness. And right? It's wise action.
Well, just to hear you say that, to conform to the whole, it's just so incredible and so... beautiful and so rare.
Anyone who challenges themselves to be humble is doing it. They don't have to actually consciousize and analyze what they're doing. Oh, I'm acknowledging that there's a whole and I'm just a part. I mean, they're just humble. Right? But that's fundamentally what humility is about, is recognition that you're a part in a greater whole. Right? So you don't have to, get into this conscious, recognition of all this. You can just be the simple little humble child of God. It's like, why are you humble? Well, mommy and daddy told me to be, so I'm humble. Right? It can be just as simple as that. Unwittingly conforming to the cosmos like that. But as you begin to get older, you recognize you've got to start having a conscious awareness of this and imposing it upon yourself. I'm determined to be humble because I choose to be, not because, I just do whatever mommy and daddy tell me to do and they told me to be humble. And we all know that loses its, loses gas after a while, runs out of steam. Right? Okay, let's keep going here.
Section 7. Remote repercussions of sin. The personal centripetal, thank you, consequences of the creature's willful and persistent rejection of light are both inevitable and individual, and are of concern only to deity and to that personal creature. Such a soul-destroying harvest of iniquity is the inner reaping of the iniquitous will creature.
Right, so, in towards the center, centripetal, are of concern only to deity and that personal creature. Sin is deliberate disloyalty to deity. Right? Just picturing that, your personality encompassment of yourself as a sphere, and that sphere is imploding. Right? It's going in towards a center in zero volume. Right? Collapsing, imploding.
So it means the capacity is
gone. The capacity is diminishing until it goes to zero, yes.
And they would not know right or wrong when they get into this place, the person.
Oh, yeah, definitely. When you go, all the way, to the point where you're disconnected from the Holy Spirit, if you're immortal, you can't know right and wrong, because that's coming from the second cosmic intuition in the Holy Spirit. Okay, so there's that inward towards the center aspect of it, but there's a reciprocal aspect as well. That's the next paragraph.
But not so with the external repercussions of sin. the impersonal centrifugal consequences of embraced sin are both inevitable and collective. Being of concern to every creature functioning within the effect range of such events.
Okay, so out from the center, centrifugal. You know, like when you're in a car and you're going around a corner and you know, you fly away from the center of curvature of the car is going around the corner. Right? The key thing there, besides literally, you know, giving you this visualization of inward and outward from a center, is the personal, impersonal contrast. Okay? Just to remind you of how just inescapably inner personal is. Right? You're not going to manifest your personality to me. Right? That exists. That personal influence on your mind exists only in the upper domain of the hourglass analogy of your mind. That's the personalized self, and that doesn't manifest the external world. The lower domain manifests the external world. Right? The fruits of a personalized self in the lower domain, the character, okay, manifests out. But just, you know, recognize that. That's why. You have to send a solitary messenger from point A to point B sometimes, right? I mean, you can't do this personal thing even over these mind conduit communication cables.
Right? Can't do it over
personal is internal, right? Again, that's not the way humans use the word personal. We use it in the sense that you're, you know, experiencing my personality right now. No, you're not. You can't. That's internal. That's in your inner life. It doesn't manifest into your outer life. Yourself manifests into your outer life. You know, if it's a mastered self manifesting into your outer life, and I can see that you have a mastered self, I logically can recognize there's a personality behind that mastered self. But I can't see the influence from eternity. All I can see is manifestations in time. Right? So again, she's challenging you to use the word personality in the revelator's mode of use, not the way everyone uses it.
But you can see it through the fruits of the Spirit.
Yes, you can see it. So you can logically recognize it by logically following back from the fruits, right?
Don't you think also there's a unique flavor to a person who has a personalized self that you can discern?
A personal self has a character.
It's unique.
The non-personalized self has a temperament. Mm-hmm. And the temperament could be quite relatively unique. That's not an expression of the personal self.
That's what I'm saying, the personal
self. Right. But just again, remember, you recognize the personality by insight. You don't literally see it.
That's what I'm trying to get.
See, that's what that contrast between sight and insight. You see the self, you recognize via insight the existence of the personality. That self that you see is under the influence of a personality. But you don't literally see the personality.
But you would maybe sense it with your insight?
You recognize, yeah, I mean, it's a reality response, if you will. You know, I mean, you recognize its existence. You know, you feel a resonance, you know, if you will, of its existence.
As a unique character. So you would be
feeling that. When we have more insight, this will be more obvious. Right? But right now we have such limited insight. This is all kind of abstract, you know, what I'm talking about. But it's important to just, again, challenge yourself to put a separation between what the personal part of you is and what the, you know, just the self, the mind, just a merely mindful part of you. Right? It's very fancy. There's all kinds of cool things, especially if it's a self under the influence of a personality. That self will do a lot fancier things than any animal will ever do. Like, it will, you will manifest a positive response to a negative stimulus. I'll never see that coming from an animal. See, and that's how I know you have a personality. The moment I see you responding positively to a negative stimulus, I know you're a person and not an animal. But I see lots of fancy animals doing nothing but responding negatively to negative stimuli and positively to positive stimuli. It's no big deal that you can put yourself in under the influence of a positive stimuli and feel joy, and I can see that you're joyful. Okay, yeah, that's a fancy animal thing. Show me something personal. Show me something unnatural. And then I know you're a person. Show me you fearing not when anyone with any eyeballs or ears should be in desperate fear. Show me you not responding with fear. Okay, and now I know that you're like Amidon.
That's the challenge.
And you stand unmoved. Right? See, that's to stand unmoved is unnatural.
It's the challenge of today.
Okay.
So the difference between you and your own personality versus recognizing someone else's personality.
Fundamentally, you'll have a different take on standing unmoved than I will.
Yeah.
There's a different flavor, you know. We're both personalities because we respond positively to a negative stimulus, but you do it in a slightly different way than I do.
Do you think it's progressive as you grow and grow and grow, you become your personality?
Yeah, the more
you understand your own personality,
more of your personality can manifest. I mean, right now, very little can get through the mechanism, the mind that you have. But the higher your mind, the more of that personality can manifest.
But it's always there. It's changeless, right?
It's changeless. Nothing's changed. It's just it's that potential, because it's just a potential. The potential stays constant.
Okay, always a potential.
And that potential actualizes through a self. Right? I mean, personality literally is, see, it's not an object that actualizes, right? It's actually the mind. That you know, the potential, personal potential, actualizes in mindal forms.
Okay.
Yeah, the personality never becomes an actual object; it remains a non-object potential.
Your thought adjuster then doesn't have a personality. You become it, or it becomes you.
Well, it becomes your body.
What?
You know, if you will. I mean, the adjuster, you can think of it in the first sense, it becomes your body, it was a first stage spirit. But
it gets a personality because
when you fuse with it, there's no longer a wall,
right,
between the two selves. The two selves become one self.
Right.
Now, there's still the technicality that the part of the adjuster's self that is now not separated from yourself anymore. It's just the very bottom, you know, part of the adjuster's self. The adjuster has this infinite vertical self, right? And you're just, you know, merging with the tiny little tip down at the bottom. But still, there's no wall between the two selves.
So, like, when you stand in front of God eventually, when you're perfect, then you're adjuster and you are. I mean, that would be the highest that you could.
But again, that's just finite perfectness. Yeah, you know, there's still an infinite amount of adjuster self to move up into. You know,
like when you go out and
the absonite and beyond the ultimate. Yeah, there's still a whole infinite range of potential to manifest more personality. Think about how much personality you'll manifest when you're a co-absolute being, right? I mean, the simplest things you do as a co-absolute being make the fanciest thing you did as an absentite being look like nothing. Right? I mean, it's all just, you know, I mean, every step makes what's before effectively nothing. Right? Because there's, you know, it doesn't matter how big a number you subtract from infinity, you still have infinity.
The eternal sun, personality infinite?
What now?
Is the eternal sun personality infinite in a way?
Yeah, I mean, that's an infinite person, yeah.
Hard to fathom.
Right. Yeah. Right. It's so hard to fathom. It's so hard to fathom that we call it not finite, infinite. Right. We have no positive term for it. We just speak of it in contrast.
Did you just coin that personality infinite?
Well, no. It's just. And remember the technicality of it is, you have co-absolute, you go above that, you have absolute, you go above that, you have co-infinite, you go above that, you have infinite, right? I mean, they're literally up there at the infinite level, right? Which is infinitely above the absolute level, if you will. I mean, anyway, it's all becomes very abstract, but... explain something that can't be explained.
Yeah. So the adjuster, once you fuse with him, then he becomes you and you become him, basically.
Right. Yeah, they're just one self.
But you're still not one with, because it says the adjuster is God, remember?
Right, but remember you got to remember the technicality. It's not a fragment of God, technically. It's a fragment of deity. Okay?
Yeah,
it also says that it loves.
Yeah.
Okay, but technically only a person can love. And it says that it has will. Yeah, but technically only a person has will. I mean, there's a number of things they say about the adjuster where you have to appreciate that effectively. I mean, from our perspective, we have such a low recognition of reality right now. I mean, the difference between something that fancy without will and something that has will is something we've never experienced. It's a meaningless distinction for us. For all practical purposes, from our perspective, you can think of it as loving, being the face of God and whatnot, but it isn't technically. I mean, remember we talked about that some. I mean, when a human saw, say, a brilliant evening star sometime in the past, when a brilliant evening star was manifested to someone, did they go, oh, that's just a lowly celestial being, that's not God? No, that was God. They were certain that absolutely, there can't be anything fancier than that. That is absolutely God. Right? I mean, we just have such a low sense of this stuff, right? If a seraphim was made manifest in front of us, it would exceed our wildest imaginations of a brilliant, radiant being. Right? And if you put a Lananadec and a seraphim in front of each of us, you go, whoa, the seraphim looks black in contrast to the Lananadec. So I guess Lananadec is God. And then you put a divine counselor next, I mean, it's all relative.
God is
Satanian. Yeah, but I'm just trying to now envision what it would be like once you fuse, and then when you finally go through all the channels that it takes to stand in front of God, and then you have your orders to progress and do whatever you have to do. Is there more of God that you experience than that?
Yeah, infinitely more. Yeah. Just remember another simple thing. I mean, if an adjuster doesn't fuse with a mortal, for instance, and ends up getting personalized directly by the Universal Father, I mean, that personalized adjuster is not God, right? It's, matter of fact, it's categorized among the ascending sons. It's just a creature. It's just a creature. It's just a creature. Without a personality, an adjuster is an entity, like these energy transmitters we were just reading about. It's a very fancy, minded entity, but it's not a person. And again, notice how it's always subservient to your will. See, it's like that energy transmitter. I mean, it can't initiate. It's subservient to your will. You have the initiator spark, not it. Okay.
By 50,000 years after the collapse of the planetary administration, earthly affairs were so disorganized and retarded that the human race had gained very little over the general evolutionary status existing at the time of Caligastia's arrival 350,000 years previously. In certain respects, progress had been made. In other directions, much ground had been lost.
Okay, so let's see, I can't remember where that was. There was a point where instead of saying conserve, they said preserve. Remember that about what Van was up to? Mm-hmm. Here you can see that fact. There is so little, and basically they're doing their best just to sort of preserve as opposed to having something that's really kind of living and expanding forward into the future. So you go 50,000 years down the road and, you know, it's in many ways, other than having this little bit sporadically higher cultural influence, right, it's almost like nothing had happened. Okay.
So is this on both sides?
Yeah, both the loyal and the disloyal sides. Where was that? Trying to find that so I could point to it. I was going to mention it when we read it, and I forgot because we got off on a tangent.
Right there on six, second sentence.
Which paragraph? It starts with which number?
The 12 words?
Right. The 12 Melchizedek receivers of Urantia. Yeah, they preserved the remnants of civilization. Yeah, see, just notice it there. That they didn't say conserved, because it was just... They were dropping back, and it was in a very minimal mode, just sort of a station keeping mode. Remember they're even trying to do that with Machaventa, they're trying to just make sure that what little is there doesn't evaporate. They're having a hard time really making it grow much. But they're at least trying to keep it from just disappearing. Okay.
Sin is never purely local in its effects. The administrative sectors of the universe are organismal. The plight of one personality must, to a certain extent, be shared by all. Sin, being an attitude of the person toward reality, is destined to exhibit its inherent negativistic harvest upon any and all related levels of universe values. But the full consequences of erroneous thinking, evil doing, or sinful planning are experienced only on the level of actual performance. The transgression of universe law may be fatal in the physical realm without seriously involving the mind or impairing the spiritual experience. Sin is fraught with fatal consequences to personality survival only when it is the attitude of the whole being, when it stands for the choosing of the mind and the willing of the soul.
And there, and you'll see it when they use soul again. I mean, they don't mean the literal Marantia object there when they're saying soul. They mean the upper domain in the hourglass analogy. They mean the personalized self of spiritualized mind, which get copied to make the literal soul object, right? But it's the personal self is up there. See, the willing is only up there. That's only the place where the personality is influencing the mind directly. But they mentioned there's this whole indirect thing, even in the bigger context. The direct thing is just on the level of actual performance, but obviously indirectly, if you're related to reality, it's affecting the whole vertical hierarchy of reality.
It has a ripple effect.
Right, and it has a ripple effect, indirectly throughout the whole structure, any and all related levels. It's obviously not going to impact the existential, but it's going to impact all the experiential. Yeah, because you notice they threw in the related levels there. But you know, just again, they're trying to get you to, you know, to properly think about things. You know, notice, you know, they even brought in that simple example of, you know, if you ignore material gravity and step off a cliff, okay, there's physical consequences, right? The transgression of universal law may be fatal in the physical realm without seriously involving the mind or impairing the spiritual experience. You know, matter, mind, and spirit, three separate aspects of reality. And, you know, reminding you, like they said up front, with the centripetal there, right? When you're talking about sin, you're talking fundamentally about that spiritualized mind that is immediately being impacted, being destroyed. You know, it's, you know, there's not going to be parts of your body falling off, you know, as you go deeper and deeper into sin. But there's less and less spiritualized mind, you know, that upper domain is being evacuated. It's, you know, becoming a vacuum up there, effectively. It's becoming void of meaning and value. Okay, keep going. Oh, you got something else here?
Yeah, there this three things here: erroneous thinking, evil doing, or sinful planning.
Right, because remember the deliberate thing. So, yeah, you can. You know, they gave you that planning contrast to just, you know, you're not just unwittingly doing something, right? You're doing what you plan to do.
It's intentional.
Right.
Deliberate.
Yeah. It's even more than intentional. It's purposeful.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
Evil and sin visit their consequences in material and social realms and may sometimes even retard spiritual progress on certain levels of universe reality. But never does the sin of any being rob another of the realization of the divine right of personality survival. Eternal survival can be jeopardized only by the decisions of the mind and the choice of the soul of the individual himself.
So you can notice how they're doing the decision-choice contrast there, right? You know, there's mindful decisions, right, but it's spiritual choices, right? And again, the soul there. In other words, the personalized self of spiritualized mind, where there's choice, in the upper domain. And again, this whole bit of, you go, okay, so they tell you, but never does the sin of any being rob another of the realization of the divine right of personality survival. Oh, well, I guess I just have to believe that. I don't know why, and I don't know why, so I'm probably going to be doubtful and get scared at times. No, understand the physics of it. Because it's not that it doesn't, it can't. Again, in the same way that your personality doesn't directly manifest, nothing that I could do can get directly into your personal domain, into that upper domain. There is no interplay with the external world between that upper domain and the external world.
And you know that. I mean, you know that there's no connection between individuals except through the whole. What connection to the whole does the iniquitous have?
Yeah.
No.
Right. They've severed themselves from the individuality of the whole and the whole. Right, yeah. See, and again, you know, as persons were linked together in the cosmic system, you know, through the top, right, through the mother, right? You can get out, you know, but not, you know, directly, just like we think of engaging the external world or you engaging me in the external world. You know, you go out through the top, but you're in the deity of the mother. And, you know, you don't have any say. That is what it is, right? And you're either synchronized with it or not. And if you're synchronized with it to some degree, you actually have related to it. There is an interplay between the upper domain and what's outside the upper domain. But, you know, that's only, this distinction is vital. That's what that whole paragraph is about. But it doesn't appear that way. Because you know, we're used to just thinking about the lower domain self, you know, interacting with the external world through our senses and stuff. And that's impersonal. And it's, you know, it's an important interplay, but it's an impersonal interplay. Can you have personal spiritual experiences with that? No, none at all. Right, there's no religion down there. Not really. There's a religious impulse, but no real religion down there. Right, there's reverence of unity down there, but there's no worship of God down there. Right? Yeah. Here, keep going.
Sin on Urantia did very little to delay biologic evolution, but it did operate to deprive the mortal races of the full benefit of the Adamic inheritance. Sin enormously retards intellectual development, moral growth, social progress, and mass spiritual attainment. But it does not prevent the highest spiritual achievement by any individual who chooses to know God and sincerely do his divine will.
Again, you can see this is what I've been stressing, that this physics, you know, where is there interplay and where is there not? Right, sin on Urantia did very little to delay biologic evolution. Right? The whole lower domain and its biologic evolution, okay, that's separate from the upper domain. Okay. They're just saying this in a number of different ways to try to help you to get this definitively separated, because it's never been separated in all of human history. So we're all confused. We're all wrapped around the axle with this stuff. You know, chooses to know God. Can you know God in the lower domain? No, not technically. God knowing this is on the sixth level of meaning. You can't even do it in the fourth level of meaning or the fifth level of meaning. It's not until you get all the way up to the sixth level of meaning that there is actual God knowing this. In the lower domain, you get some notion of God input to you, told you, and you might get up to the reverence of unity in there. You combine the reverence of unity with this notion of God that you've been taught, and you call that God knowingness. No, that's God notion knowingness, or technically not even knowingness, feelingness. That's God notion feelingness.
I'm a drop of water in there.
That's not actual God knowingness. Right? Now, and remember, it's effectively an infinite distance up from the beginning, God knowingness, to God consciousness. How much less is there God consciousness in the lower domain? You know, so when they use that term in here, does any human actually know what they're referring to when they use that term, God consciousness? No. No. The best human has, you know, is rightly God-knowing. But that's many philosophic levels up to God consciousness. Way, way up.
Right? Did Jesus get that far?
You get up in there when you fuse with your adjuster, of course. But that, you know, I mean, you have God consciousness up in your super consciousness by grace, that thread of encirclement of the Holy Spirit. Okay, there's God consciousness, but it's way, way super conscious. Right? But eventually you get up to there, and that's what was super conscious is conscious.
Maybe not in this life.
Maybe not in this life. Yes. Okay, keep going.
Caligastia rebelled. Adam and Eve did default. But no mortal subsequently born on Urantia has suffered in his personal spiritual experience because of these blunders. Every mortal born on Urantia since Caligastia's rebellion has been in some manner time penalized. But the future welfare of such souls has never been in the least eternity jeopardized. No person is ever made to suffer vital spiritual deprivation because of the sin of another. Sin is wholly personal as to the moral guilt or spiritual consequences. Notwithstanding its far-flung repercussions in administrative, intellectual, and social domains.
Again, no person is ever made because you can't. By design, it's absolutely separated, and there can't be an interplay like that. you are sovereign in that upper domain. Right? That is your place and your place alone. No one can defile it but you. And what's the essential definition of religion? Personal spiritual experience. Right? So think about how many times you've said, oh man, the rebellion, the default, it's just a catastrophic to religion on the planet. No. No mortal subsequently born on Urantia has suffered in his personal spiritual experience. See, again, like I said, I mean, so how much is this personal spiritual experience something that's consciously been recognized by humans throughout history? This thing they keep talking about that they call religion, genuine religion, personal spiritual experience. Remember, like I said, when you look in the dictionary, none of the definitions of the word faith are true. None. So how much conscious recognition of genuine faith has there ever been if you can't look it up in the dictionary? Every definition in the dictionary is false. It's not faith, it's belief. Every definition is about belief. Faith has nothing to do with belief. Right. So again, see the challenge.
Paul had a pretty interesting
faith. Right? I mean, he had, but again, you know.
Is that belief?
Yeah, right? I mean, it's just the beginning inklings. Some have seen the shadow. I mean, there is faith up there. Superconsciously, there's genuine faith. But the trick is getting it into enough conscious recognition that someone could actually write the proper definition in the dictionary. See? And not, we're all been living in the shadow of genuine faith. To get the substance of faith, right, in your hands.
Chris, how are we time penalized?
Oh,
what
just...
What do you mean by your website?
yeah.
My clock.
When you have to kind of go it on your own, you can learn by both, you know, you have a self predicated on nature and a self resulting from nurture. And when the nurture is basically not there, you have to kind of self nurture, and that's a very slow process. To go from effectively first mansion world to second mansion world here is a lot slower than going from the first mansion world to the second mansion world, actually on the mansion worlds, where you have this wonderful environment that you're in, right? And so you aren't time penalized by the emptiness of the environment. You don't have all this incredible stimulus that you have there. That's what they mean. It just takes longer. Because you're having to search through a vast field. You know, it's like mining for some rare mineral, you know. And you take out 60 dump truck loads, you know, and get one tiny little ounce of it. Right? That's what we're having to do. okay.
While we cannot fathom the wisdom that permits such catastrophes, we can always discern the beneficial outworkings of these local disturbances as they are reflected out on the universe at large.
We'll come back to that a little bit, you know, and think about what they technically mean, why we cannot fathom the wisdom. So just hold on that a little bit here. Let's keep reading in the final section here.
Section 8, the human hero of the rebellion. The Lucifer Rebellion was withstood by many courageous beings in the various worlds of Satania, but the records of Salvington portray Amidon as the outstanding character of the entire system in his glorious rejection of the flood tides of sedition and in his unswerving devotion to Van. They stood together, unmoved in their loyalty to the supremacy of the Invisible Father and his son Michael.
I already kind of gave that one away, right? You see, why is that? Because again, it's just there aren't any more lowly will creatures. The fact that the lowliest will creature possible stood so firm in the midst of such an assault. I mean, everyone was just agog throughout the whole super universe at that. You know, that such, that Homo erectus could stand unmoved, right?
Yeah.
You know, okay, it's cool when a Sangik does, but seriously, yeah. Something that limited, right? Yeah, I had help and stuff, but, right, but not all of the modified Andonites had the same amount of potential help, but not all of them. And so it's not a given. So it's a very profound thing to see that even something with that little mind capacity, you give it a personality that's like any other personality in the universe of universes, mortal or not, and there's infinite potential there. The mustard seed is always there. No matter how small the mustard seed starts out, it's still a mustard seed. So that's the deal. The flood tides of sedition did not wash him away.
So he didn't grow discontent.
Right. He couldn't be taken off center, you know, off into the deserts of discontent, as it were.
At the time of these momentous transactions, I was stationed on Adentia, and I am still conscious of the exhilaration I experienced as I perused the Salvington broadcasts, which told from day to day of the unbelievable steadfastness, the transcendent devotion, and the exquisite loyalty of this one-time semi-savage, springing from the experimental an original stock of the Andonic race.
You know, just stressing the low, you know, one-time semi-savage. I mean,
this is the first occurrence.
In many ways, this is like just an animal. I mean, it's you know, you have to kind of, you know, sort of close your eyes and imagine to see it as a human, even, you know, instead of just an animal.
The plan
works. Right.
So the communication circuits were broken, though, right? And they got broadcast day to day.
Oh, well, you know, you've got, you know, remember, you've got personal messengers, you've got solitary messengers and whatnot. I mean, there's information flowing, you just don't have the circuits. You know, they're sort of pushing their superlatives there, you notice. Yeah. Unbelievable steadfastness, transcendent devotion, exquisite loyalty. Again, just to try to make the point of the contrast. I mean, you're bridging the greatest gulf. You know, there is no wider distance between sophistry proof and Amadon, right, than that kind of a will creature. To be that steadfast and yet hardly be able to see, let alone see. Right. And see, and that's why it's sad to record. Right? I mean, look what Amadon did. And he's got, you know, such a minuscule fraction of what you have. Right? And it's, and the fact that all of us languish and stumble along in moral darkness is very sad to record.
Well, we had Van to look to, but he couldn't... Elanana Dexan was still brilliant compared to looking at Van.
Mm-hmm. You know, yeah, right.
I mean, he had to see him with his insight.
Right. I mean, because by sight, like I said, the contrast, if you stick the Elanana Dex next to Van looks black against next to the Elanana Dex. If you went by sight, it seems like it's an obvious, so, you know, which is the light and which is the darkness. Right? You have to have insight. Right? The Lananadec is brilliantly white on the outside, but black on the inside. Van is relatively black on the outside, but inside, right, is radiant illumination. Right?
But plenty of other Ananites did fall over for Van.
Yeah, yeah. Because again, you know, we're easily led by the nose ring, by sight. If it's beautiful, you'll follow it anywhere.
So could you call this a supreme choice that
yes.
God
yeah.
had to
no.
face all of us?
Yeah, these are taking Amidon is taking a hold of that supreme thread that was given to him by grace and not letting go, right? Okay, let's see. I'll keep on. Yep.
From Edentia up through Salvington and even on to Uversa, for 7 long years, the first inquiry of all subordinate celestial life regarding the Satania rebellion ever and always was, what of Amidon of Urantia? Does he still stand unmoved?
Yes, you have to love that one. It's one of the greatest things ever. You know, and that's not my opinion. That's the entire super universe's opinion. That's one of the greatest things ever. The last 300 trillion years, that's one of the greatest things ever. We don't need to, we talk about that all the time. Keep going.
If the Lucifer rebellion has handicapped the local system in its fallen worlds, the loss of this son and his misled associates has temporarily hampered the progress of the constellation of Nerlashadek, then weigh the effect of the far-flung presentation of the inspiring performance of this one child of nature and his determined band of 143 comrades in standing steadfast for the higher concepts of universe management and administration in the face of such tremendous and adverse pressure exerted by his disloyal superiors. And let me assure you, this has already done more good in the universe of Nebadon and the super universe of Orvinton than can ever be outweighed by the sum total of all the evil and sorrow of the Lucifer Rebellion.
Just that one individual, right? So, power of a mustard seed. And see, when they say that, and you go back, well, now what do they mean? While we cannot fathom the wisdom that permits such catastrophes, it's like, well, what do you mean you can't fathom it? You just said it's like, look at you just made goodness that can't be made any other way. You know, that is this exquisite quality. I mean, that's the wisdom, is it not? But see, what do they mean? They can't fathom. Again, remember, they're thinking very scientifically, if you will. They don't understand yet directly why that's the only way it can be done. It's like, are you sure there isn't some other way you could get that? Right? Because again, their minds don't encompass all of the physics of the total finite. If it did, then they go, oh, no, that is the only way. Like, the only way you can make one of those really cool supreme adjusters is for them to ride an iniquitous will creature down to the bottom. Right? Like, are you sure there isn't some other way? No, there's no other way. See, and again, it's a supreme, again, supreme indicating the total finite. It's only in the context of you being able to recognize the physics of the total finite that you get that. So they're always very humble. You know, if they don't literally can't write out the equations how this works, you know, they'll say, well, you know, we just aren't really certain about. It's like, well, isn't it just logically obvious? Yeah. It's they would say, sure, it's logically obvious, but I mean, the actual reasoning, the technical scientific issues, the how of it all, that's what they haven't, they don't know the physics of it all. That's what they mean by that.
Reminds me of the Harmonian natives that, mm-hmm. Haven't experienced the things that we experience, but they're just naturally that way.
Yeah.
So, they don't get it.
Can a Havona native fathom altruism? No, because they can't experience altruism.
I mean,
in the most trivial altruism is completely beyond their imagination, their possibility of experience.
The inspiration, I would think, as you say, you know, the bottom of the bottom,
mm-hmm.
you know, standing steadfast is just another, you know, another home run for God, so to speak.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. And like I was saying, that huge separation, that voltage, see, yeah. actually powered something. That potential actualized.
Yeah.
And everyone's got, oh, that is the coolest thing ever. I didn't even know there was voltages that large, you know, let alone that they could get actualized to make such a magnificent actuality, such a magnificent manifestation of goodness, right, and integrity.
It's exhilarating.
Yep.
How cool for Michael, because it happened on his watch.
Yeah. So, just one little quick thing, we're running late, but, you know, remember how they tell you there's all these incredible stories they could tell about some of the other bestowals, you know, Michael and stuff, you know, but they're not allowed to, these really cool things that happen. So, you know, that just, you know, remember if there are these sort of just the remarkably amazing, wonderful stories that they could tell, but this one still stands apart. See, and again, it's the only way you can recognize this, you can't just go by the actuality. There's other actualities that are just as cool in some ways, right? I mean, like Panopsia, say, or with Eleanor or something. But it's just the potentiality, the differential that was crossed. See, it's so different than anything that happened on any of those other bestowals or in other worlds or anything, because there just aren't these Andonites, these pre-Sangic creatures that could ever stand unmoved. Yeah. All right, let's wrap it up here.
And all this is a beautifully touching and superbly magnificent illumination of the wisdom of the Father's universal plan for mobilizing the core of mortal finality on paradise and for recruiting this vast group of mysterious servants of the future, largely from the common clay of the mortals of ascending progression, just such mortals as the impregnable Amidon, presented by Melchizedek of Nebadon.
Okay, ends with that little poetic flourish. But just one little thing. Why did they say impregnable? Rather than some other, you know, inconcussable, unshakable, indomitable, or, you know, I mean, other, you know, any, why did they say impregnable? Okay, you know, it's not, you know, it's the IM means prefix is not, and not in, right? It's not that kind of impregnate. So he's not pregnable. Oh, yeah. The seeds could not be sown. The seeds of sedition could not be sown in his mind. Remember, I try to stress that analogy many times as we were going through. See, they ended with that, right? That seed could not be planted in him. He's impregnable. So the key is to not somehow, you know, be able to resist it if it gets in there. No, you don't let it in.
So that takes a personality to do that.
Yeah, and see, and you're not sophistry resistant. You're sophistry proof. Right? You're impregnable. Right? Yeah, so that's the key. See, they actually ended on that visualization to purposely use that word to get you to reflect on the physics of it a little bit. It's not like somehow you just, you know, you're in the midst of it, you know, but you're resisting it. You stand unmoved. No, it can't get in. You're impervious. All right. So that's it for the planetary prince. We'll start on civilization next time. So we've got this big long arc on civilization here, this block of papers on civilization.
I just wanted to say, we can be like him.
Yes, we can. Now, I mean, okay, let me just say that. Why did they tell that story? So you can, you know, get a quasi-worship going for Amidon? No. No, to recognize that you can do that too. Right? Matter of fact, you can have the faith of Jesus too. Right? It's sad to record that we could be that and we choose not to be. Right? Because it's a choice to be that, and hence it's a choice not to be that. Just choose to be impregnable. All right, let's take a moment, everyone.